This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June, and we believe there's no time quite like the summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It's your host, Cindy House. Well, hello and hi. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope everything is going great. We have Lori Lewis, bluegrass queen, on Basic Folk today. Very excited to get into that. But first, how you doing? Have you signed up for Basic Folk's newsletter? You can do so very easily at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media. I'm going to tell you that Instagram is the biggest bang for your buck, but we're also on Facebook and YouTube. Is TikTok a thing anymore? We have an account. I haven't opened the app in quite a while. I'm afraid to, honestly. To be honest, I'm afraid to do anything with TikTok right now. But you can find us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. You can also become a supporter, throw us some dollars. You can make your contribution at basicfolk.com/donate, or the link is in the show notes. All right, Lori Lewis, originally part of the 70s Bay Area bluegrass scene, Lori Lewis knows the power of collaboration. She's been part of an ensemble in recent years that called themselves Lori Lewis and the Right Hands, with Lori on fiddle, guitar, and vocals, Brandon Godman on fiddle, George Guthrie on banjo, and Hazy Siako on string bass. They play a huge part on her new album, O California, a collection of songs that explore our places in the natural world and in each other's hearts that also serves as a love letter to her home state. One standout track, the traditional Fair and Tender Ladies, is a duet with Siako, and that really makes the song and cautionary tale come alive. In our conversation, Lori talks about what it's been like to learn traditional songs and then actually catching their meanings long after figuring out the tune. She emphasizes the communal and collaborative nature that defines her musicianship. She recounts her early exposure to music played socially when her father and his friends gathered at their home to all play classical music when she was young. She marks that experience with solidifying her decision to learn to play so she could have as much fun as they did. Lori opens up about her path to finding independence from her father's expectations and her eventual return to music through modern dance and folk tradition. She also touches on her passion for nature, recounting transformative hiking experiences, and reveals her thoughts on collaboration and mentorship within the music community. Additionally, she reflects on the profound impact of losing her voice in 2021 and the emotional journey of rediscovering her musical identity. We wrap up our conversation talking about her friend Alice Gerard, whom she covers on the new album. After we hung up, Lori emailed me an addendum about Alice that I wanted to share. Lori says, I forgot to say when you asked me about Alice Gerard that I also greatly admire her community involvement in the music she loves, as evidenced by her starting and running the Old Time Herald for so many years. She's a remarkable person. Plus, she trained her dog to fetch a beer out of the fridge for her and then put the empty can in the recycling. Just incredible. We'll listen to a clip of that traditional song, Fair and Tender Ladies, from the new album, O California. And then we'll get to our conversation with Lori Lewis on Basic Folk.
Come all ye fair and tender ladies, take warning how you court young men.
They're like the stars on a summer's morning,
First they'll appear and then they're gone. They'll tell to you some loving story. They'll swear to you that their love is true.
Straightway they'll go and court some other.
And that's the love they have for you.
Lori Lewis, welcome to Basic Folks. So glad to have you on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I wanted to talk about your early musical surroundings. Like, you are very much in the folk tradition, but you weren't necessarily exposed to that tradition at a very young age. But you were witness to performing music socially, which is like definitely part of the folk tradition. Your dad was a doctor who played flute and piccolo with his doctor friends. And you have stories of listening to them playing while you were in bed. It sounds like they were having so much fun.
Exactly, yeah.
It's interesting to me that it was classical music that he was playing socially. What can you say about that style of music, usually like so rigid, so defined, being performed in that type of setting?
Well, let's see, what can I say about that? It's kind of a testament to the looseness of those, that particular group of people, that they could just, they were just reading, sight reading woodwind quintets, and they would sit around and have fun and sight read, and then they'd screw up and go back, oh, let's go back to B and take it from there or something. And to my mind, it wasn't too different from sitting around and playing music with people not reading music. Although I have to say that, you know, I studied classical violin, and one of my big problems with the classical violin was the actual reading of music. I was so, I guess it was tension. I'm not exactly sure what. My parents thought at first I was allergic to rosin and that it was an allergic reaction.
Like a for real allergic, or they were being
for
funny?
For real. No, for okay. real. They got me some synthetic okay. rosin to see if it would help. And it did not. It's just, I would get so tense. My eyes would just get beet red. And it was very hard for me to read music and make music come out of the instrument at the same time. I am a terrible sight reader, and I never depend on music reading. I mean, I can read a chart fine, but not the little dots on paper for some reason.
Yeah, so that's so interesting because
I'm kind of a dyslexic kid, so maybe that had something to do with it.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Like, okay, so I have this question about how you kind of had this, like, incredible pull towards like bluegrass and towards like folk and roots music. Like, it seems like almost cosmic, you know, and me hearing that you had such a hard time sight reading, yet you're such a like a legendary accomplished player, it feels like it is this kind of like cosmic huge thing for you.
I guess that you know, it's part of your strengths being defined by your weaknesses, you know. I honestly seem to have a physiological issue with reading music. Therefore, I fell in love with a music that I don't have to read, possibly.
Amazing. Great, right. Another question about your dad. So for better or worse, he was a big part of your early musical journey. But it sounds like he could be like heavy-handed in his encouragement to the point where you were discouraged. But it seemed like he never gave up pushing you towards music. Like, he really wanted you to play classical, but eventually it seems like he accepted and then like fully leaned into your love of bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
In thinking about that, how do you reflect on your dad's role in your musicality?
Well, I think it both hindered me and helped me, and possibly in about equal equal amounts. I was a very, very shy kid and pretty much afraid of any adult figure. I don't know why that was. It just was in me. My mom says she was the same way, so maybe it's genetic, you know? There's a shyness gene, I suppose. And
your generational trauma.
Yeah. Who knows? To hiding out in the fjalls of Norway or something. Afraid the Vikings will come and get us. I'm not sure.
Exactly. Right.
But anyway, besides all that, my dad would try and get me to perform when I really did not want to. And it got much worse after my parents got divorced, and it was a very litigious and ugly divorce. And my dad was the bad guy. And so I just didn't want to do anything my dad wanted me to do aside from that. But after I sort of escaped playing music for a while and went into modern dance, which he didn't understand anything about or didn't really care about, I got my own firm footing of who I was and what I wanted to do, more or less. And I wasn't going to be cowed by his expectations or his what he wanted me to do. So I think that it was great that he introduced me to a lot of music, and he encouraged a lot of stuff. I mean, I really, really appreciate that. But it got to a point where I had to escape him and learn to not pay attention to him. And then when he came back, when I got interested in music again, or reinterested in playing music again and singing, he came around sort of almost as soon as I started performing. And he was just so full of ideas of what I should be doing, you know, and he heard me yodel and he goes, oh, you should yodel in every set. You should do this and you should do that. And you should always play the banjo and you should, you know, and then play the violin too. And of course you should play guitar, and kind of wanted me to be a Barbara Mandrell sort of, you know, here I am playing the pedal steel and here I am, you know, dancing and here I am doing this and that. And I had learned by that point to just go, no.
That's
tough. Thank you, but no.
Yeah.
And I was in my 20s at that point.
Yeah.
So,
oh, wow.
So, but he introduced me to a lot of wonderful people, and he became such a fan that he was constantly promoting my music to other people. You know, he would get, anytime I made a new CD, he would get it and, you know, give them away to all of his friends, and I've certainly expanded my fan base that way.
Nice.
Yeah.
So in his playing with his friends in a social setting and you feeling like that was so much fun, that was a huge incentive for you to start playing music with other people.
Yeah.
When did you start playing with other people, and how did it feel versus how you thought it might feel?
Well, there's like, maybe there's two separate start times. There's when I was a teenager and I was playing music, and I was playing. I loved playing with my friend Dana, and we would work. We would like meticulously work out harmonies, and you know who was playing guitar on what, or who was, you know, capoed where or doing something, and we would just. She loved Irish music, and so we would do a lot of Irish music, and that was my first experience of playing music with other people that was really joyful and fun, and also frustrating and painstaking and all of that other stuff, which music is. But when I was maybe 22 or so, 23, I found the kind of Bay Area bluegrass music scene. And that just really, I was just in love immediately. This was the music that I'd heard as a teenager, that I loved, that I was trying to play on the banjo, that I didn't know anybody else that was interested in. But suddenly, there they all were. And they were fantastic musicians. And it was so much fun to just sit and play a tune together and see what somebody else would do and how that would influence what you would do. And it's like having a conversation. As a shy person, having a musical conversation is a lot easier than having an actual sit-down communication without an instrument in front of you.
Yeah. I found this line from you about the bluegrass scene in Northern California. You said, there weren't a lot of cutting contests. It was all about making music together, a focus on interdependency rather than individual prowess. So how do you think that original collaboration over competition vibe impacts the type of musician that you are today?
Oh, I definitely am much more like that. I mean, the latest album is a real band album that all the four of us just all worked on together. Every single arrangement is collaborative, and you know, all the harmony parts, everything is just a collaboration all the way. And I have just loved that aspect of human interaction. It's been my go-to human interaction, I think, since I was a kid.
Hmm. Do you feel like you have a competitive side?
Well, I mean, sometimes. I think sometimes it's complicated, I would say, because sometimes I feel like, well, maybe I don't really get the recognition that I might deserve if people were actually paying attention and listening to me.
Right.
But on the other hand, I have a big streak, as I think many, many musicians do, of just, I mean, I know my worth in terms of cutting contests and that kind of competition. And I would get cut down immediately. So maybe it's just I know what my strengths are, and my strengths are in collaboration rather than.
And they're not reading music.
Yeah.
And they're not cutting competitions.
Yeah, because I would fail.
I have kind of a weird women versus men in bluegrass question. Maybe it's not a versus, but like women and men and the differences. And this question was inspired by your partner, Tom Rosen. It was from an interview where he was talking about how you first met and then what it was like to start playing together. And I was wondering if you could explain to someone who is not well-versed in bluegrass or in playing music what he is talking about. So he says, playing in keys suited to a woman's voice also made me relax, knowing that my playing wouldn't include as many of the predictable licks that one hears when other bands share the same or similar material. So I was grateful not to feel like a competing athlete in the Bluegrass Olympics.
Yeah, that's a very insightful little thing of Tom's. I mean, for one thing, okay, there's a big streak in bluegrass of, you know, well, you got to play it like the masters played it. You know, there's a very strong traditional, although we could get into what's actually traditional or not, but a very strong streak in bluegrass about, you know, well, you got to play that lick like Bill Monroe did or something like that. But if you instantly change the whole footing by saying, well, we're not going to do it in the standard key of B. We're going to do it in D because that's where it suits my voice, not Bill Monroe's voice or whatever.
Okay.
Whoever's voice. So instantly you're not expected to transfer the exact licks or the exact feel, because keys do make a difference in how something sounds. You know, what you can do in that key is different than what you could do in another. So what Tom is so eloquently saying is that he was freed playing with a woman lead singer as opposed to playing in a male band where you were going to be more, where it's already an anomaly, or it was at the time. It hardly is anymore, which is so fantastic. But it was already an anomaly to have a woman lead singer and band leader. So all those people who expect the traditional thing, they're just not going to get it in the way they expect to get it.
So the Bluegrass Olympics is not sort of like, because I was thinking about it in terms of like, we can play really fast and we can play really hard, but the Bluegrass Olympics is more like the bluegrass beauty pageant of like, who is the most like Ralph Stanley?
Well, possibly. Yeah. Yeah. I think there was a lot of that in there in what Tom is saying. I mean, we can play hard and we can play fast, but it might sound different because it's being a different key.
Mentorship. You have a reputation for being a generous and passionate mentor.
Oh, that's...
making sure that younger players feel welcome, especially young women. It made me interested to know, did you have any women mentors in bluegrass? And what can you say about how you learned to be a good mentor?
Let's see. That's maybe, yes, I had women mentors in bluegrass. Here in the Bay Area, it was different than most places, I think, around the country in the 1970s. When I first went to Paul's Saloon in San Francisco, the first band I saw had a woman fiddler in the band. And the second band I saw had a woman mandolin player in the band. And probably the third band I went to see had a woman guitar player in the band. And so the Bay Area was different that way. You know, there were already a lot of women involved, and the feeling in the community was, if you love the music and if you want to play it and, you know, honor it, we don't care if you're from Mars, you know, just come on over, and or Venus for that matter. just play the music and we'll accept whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that didn't really strike me as being a thing until I started touring and talking to other women from other parts of the country. I know that the Lynn Morris's experiences, for instance, are radically different from mine when she started playing. And we've talked about that in the past. But I think when I really started recognizing, I've never really thought of myself as a mentor, but if you just get excited about what young people are doing and are really listening, I guess they can latch onto you and take you as a mentor.
Yeah. That seems like the best way to do it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Map out a plan.
Yeah, I never mapped out a plan. I actually, a thing that really helped me was being asked to be a part, to teach at a fiddle camp that was specifically for kids, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 14-year-olds, you know. I was really leery about doing it. I said, I don't know if I can teach kids.
Right.
But because being a self-employed musician, I've always been mostly in the camp of saying yes to everything. So even though I was afraid and didn't know how to do it, I just said yes. And it ended up being, I taught at the camp for about 6 years in a row and made some of my best friends who grew up to be wonderful musicians there. And I just feel like it's been a super important part of my life.
Hmm. Another really important part of your life is being outside. You enjoy hiking, walking. You do these amazing whitewater rafting bluegrass trips.
Yeah.
You will post and reference hikes in the woods and walks around the city. There are endless references to the outside world in your songs. How does being in nature inspire you as an artist, and when did that begin?
Oh, I've just always been an outdoor child. I've just always been fascinated with wild animals and bugs and trees and grass. It's always been my thing. I don't know how that started. But there were a number of decades in my life where I was not really in touch with that very much. I was really had my nose to the grindstone in terms of touring with my band and working in a violin shop. And I just never had any time really to look around me. And I would get out, you know, maybe up on Mount Tamalpais or something, and I would just, something would open up inside me, but I just never prioritized the time that I needed.
What changed?
Well, what really changed was I was in my 60s and early 60s, and my friend Betty Wheeler asked me if I would hike the John Muir Trail with her. And before I got into music professionally, I had backpacked a lot as a teenager and a you know, young adult. But I'd kind of like forgotten about it. I don't know. But she asked me to do this like 22-day hike with her backpacking. And I said yes, because it's what I do. I said yes.
Right, you say yes.
Yes. And it was just, I mean, it just blew my mind. And I mean, I had been out, you know, I'd already spent every year I'd go on a couple of river trips, and I loved being outdoors, but there was something about just having it all on my back, having everything I needed on my back, and just being out there and having nothing else to do except walk, that just really made me realize how incredibly important it is for me to do it more and more. So
wow.
I've been doing it more and more.
You experienced paralysis in your larynx, which resulted in you losing your voice for 6 months back in 2021.
Yeah.
I read this about the beautiful show you did at the Freight in the Bay Area, where friends came and sang your songs, and it seemed like that was such a huge, like, healing experience for you. It sounds like such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that it makes me cry to just think of it. I mean, I have had for almost 30 years at that time, I had had an annual show at the Freight and Salvage, which was my annual night, the Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And when I lost my voice, I mean, I honestly could not sing at all. I could talk, but I couldn't put any pressure on my vocal cords.
Sure.
Because only one side was working. And the doctors had said, well, you know, it comes back 50% of the time.
Jeez.
It might come back, it might not. You know, and I was just like, oh, God, what am I going to do? And throughout all of that, I just did not want to give up my night at the Freight. So
right.
I thought, what can I do? And I thought, I'll just ask some people if they would come and sing my songs. And everybody I asked said yes.
And I know you say yes all the time.
It's what we do.
Yes.
Everybody I asked said yes. And they I put up a Dropbox folder of all my songs, and they just went through and picked things, and nobody picked the same thing.
Wow.
I was like, it was kind of the best Lori Lewis night ever.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I was just, that kind of, feeling that kind of support from the community was really wonderful.
Was it a surprise?
It was a surprise to me that everybody said yes. And it was a surprise that it was as good as it was. But after everybody said yes, I knew it was going to be amazing because they're great musicians. Mm-hmm. And they're all song stylists, you know. They're not, mm-hmm. going back to that bluegrass analogy, bluegrass thing of, you know, trying to imitate. Nobody really tried to imitate me. They just took my songs and did them in the ways that they heard them in their heads, which was on some occasions, very, very different.
Yeah.
And allowed me to hear my songs in a totally different way, too. I really appreciated it on all levels.
I wanted to ask you about, in that time where you couldn't sing, how did your relationship to your other instrument change while you had no voice?
I didn't want to do anything. Mm. I mean, I honestly did not feel like I wanted to play fiddle. I didn't feel like I wanted to play guitar. It made me realize that what I love most in music is my ability to communicate to an audience or whoever is listening. And I feel like I do that best with my voice, partly because it's it's so direct. You know, you can use actual lyrics. Mm-hmm. actual words. And when I lost my voice, I just felt like I lost everything. I didn't feel like playing the fiddle. I didn't feel like playing the guitar. Mm. It just made me realize that I'm kind of a one-track mind person, maybe.
Wow. What has it been like getting to know your new voice?
It's interesting. I like aspects of it quite a bit. There are places where I have to learn to jump around over and under things that that are still kind of rough spots in my voice. But I'm having fun. I'm having fun relearning how to use it. And it's changed, in fact, from the time we recorded the album, say, it's been now like a year or so ago now that some of the recordings were done. And my voice has changed since then.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's changed for the better as things have opened back up. But, I don't know.
How do you think it's changed since the album?
Well, I've gained more of my high notes back again, mm-hmm. which is great. And I'm relearning how to navigate the voice break between chest and head. And the top of my chest voice is more, I can count on it more than I used to be able to.
That's great. Awesome.
Yeah, I know.
It's exciting.
It is great.
Okay, the new album, O California, it'll be out by the time this interview is released. You're talking about how it is like a truly band album, a real collaboration. And as a band leader, you say that you learn from your bandmates while helping them make their best music. What did you learn from your band during this recording session?
Well, I learned how truly awesome they all are. That was pretty great. let's see. What did I learn from them? Everybody's got something to offer. Not every suggestion is a great one. But there are, if you listen to everything and honestly try everything, you'll find that there's a lot more richness than what certainly than what I could come up with on my own. And I really appreciate that. It makes me appreciate them even more.
Hmm. You shared a photo of yourself when you were 14 years old with a banjo, and that's right around the time that you started playing the traditional song Fair and Tender Ladies. The new recording of that song is just outstanding. I was floored when I heard it. It's a duet between you and Hazy Siako, your bass player.
Mm-hmm.
It was her idea to split the verses and make it a duet, so her voice comes in and then your voice comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, I don't know how old she is, but she's a lot, she's younger.
She's younger than me, yeah. I think I figured that by the time I'm twice her age, she'll be like 45 and I'll be 90 or something like that.
Right on. Still yeah. Singing this song.
Probably. I hope so.
How did this approach change that song for you?
Oh, it's just made it so much better. I mean, for one thing, it's easier to find a key for the song because the version of it that we sing really has quite a range in it. And breaking it up made it just way easier to find a key that was suitable. Because it starts off maybe a little hazy, sing a little higher than I would maybe start it if I were singing the lead. But then it goes pretty low. So, I don't know. I also just, I like the aspect of it being two women's voices.
Mm-hmm.
Less of a, oh, woe is me sort of thing. And more of
right.
a... more of a statement.
So in that photo of you when you were 14, you wrote in the caption that, you know, you started playing this song right around the time you were 14, Fair and Tender Ladies. You did not know what it meant. You just thought it was a nice song, which made me wonder how you have come to relate to the meanings of, like, different traditional songs that you've been playing since when you were young. When can you recall times where you became, like, conscious of what the message of any particular traditional song was?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm not sure if I can think of an exact thing. Things have just sort of morphed and changed over the years. As a young person singing a murder ballad, for instance, where, you know, a woman is stabbed and beaten, dragged by her hair and thrown in the river, is it's like
a little different when you're a few years older.
Yeah, it the impact of it is quite a bit stronger as you know, get it out of the horror film and into real life sort of aspect. And so it's changed my attitude about songs like that. I don't have a thing about not singing any murder ballads, but I would check them at the door first and make sure that I really know what it is I'm singing about.
Right. Right. I used to, in thinking about, you know, the meanings of songs, I used to be a DJ, like a morning DJ, and we used to play NPR news headlines. And, you know, this day and age, you're not, most DJs are not playing their songs off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
Your shows have been scheduled out in advance. You know, you've got your computer playlist going, and there was like some news story about a shooting. And then my first song coming out of that was Smackwater Jack.
Wow.
Carole King,
yeah.
Which is about a guy who has a gun, and somebody, you know, somebody complained, and I was like, oh, geez, yeah, like, oh, yeah. You do have to sometime, I mean, you have to be conscious and be aware
of
stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And I imagine, like, really, like, learning a song, like, crawling inside of it, learning the music, learning the lyrics, and learning how to sing it, it would have, like, an even greater surprise when all of a sudden you're like, whoa, wait, what am I singing?
Yeah, exactly. Well, other things. I mean, I was a child of the 60s in Berkeley, California. And so it's like protest singing was, you know, I learned every Dylan song, you know, word for word. I can't remember them all now, but, you know, singing Masters of War and, you know, of course, Where Have All the Flowers Gone and all that stuff. But it's like when you really see, luckily not firsthand, but it really, it changed my life a lot when I was maybe 16 years old and I went to sing with a group of high school kids for Navy soldiers, sailors at the Oak Knoll Naval Medical Hospital. And the song that they wanted to hear the most was Where Have All the Flowers Gone? And it just, it really hit me then. I mean, I had heard, I knew the song, I'd learned the song, but yeah. I never had connected it to their plight.
Yeah, that's powerful. Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, you gotta just learn the songs and then hope that you catch their meaning.
Yeah.
At some point.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the song Red Rocking Chair.
Ah.
Kind of like Fair and Tender Ladies, it features lead vocals that are not you. Who is singing on that song?
That's George Guthrie.
George Guthrie, banjo.
Banjo, and okay. A little bit of guitar. Plays guitar on Oak, California.
How did you come to decide that someone else would take a lead on a song on this record? With Hazy doing Fair and Tender Ladies and George on Red Rocking Chair.
Because they just sound so good. And if it's going to be a band album, it needs to reflect more of what we do in a show, which is like, I am not the single thing happening, you know. It's a collaboration with these three other people. And so that's why there's, you know, Brandon Godman's featured on a fiddle tune, and Hazy and George are both featured on vocals, because I love their vocals and I want to hear them.
I like that.
I figure whoever's going to buy the album is going to really like it too. Like, also, you know, I like variety.
Yeah.
It makes for a richer roux to have everybody involved.
Hmm. Okay, one more question and then a quick lightning round.
Uh-oh.
Yes. The song Sweet South Anna River was written by your friend Alice Gerard. It's the only song on the record that's not either a traditional song or one written by you. I just wanted to hear, what does this song mean to you? What does Alice's writing mean to you?
The world. I just think Alice is, golly, I'm just getting all emotional talking about all these things I love. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's also, now this is a part of me that I've never been able to kind of control is how emotional I feel when I start, how emotional I get when I start talking about things that I'm really passionate about.
Right. The floodgates is what we like to call that.
Yep. Yep.
They've opened.
Yes. Okay. So. I have been an admirer of Alice's writing and singing for decades. And it wasn't until I produced an album of hers called Bittersweet, which is all her original songs. It's many original songs. And Sweet South Anna River is on that. And it's a very different arrangement. It's very sort of rubato in a way. It's piano, cello, and violin. And it's and there are other voices. But I love that song. And that's been like 10 years ago that I recorded that album for Alice. And I've been thinking about that song ever since.
Wow.
And so I just thought, well, now's the time. I've got to do it. And so we worked it out. And instantly, the quartet sounds so beautiful on it, I think. With who knew George, who sings higher than me on this album sometimes, on some of the harmony parts, who knew he was a bass singer as well? I didn't. Until
that's talent.
We just started, you know, working out, okay, trying to make Brandon sing bass because George and Hazy and I are used to the trio right together. And it just didn't work. Brandon didn't have those notes in his range. And George said, well, let me try it. And bam, it just worked immediately.
I feel like that's the kind of stuff where if you are a good leader, people feel welcome to kind of step up and offer themselves in that way. And that's really cool, Lori.
Well, I hope that that's true. And yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do this lightning round.
She says yes again.
She says yes again. Word of the day, yes. Okay, let's wipe away our emotions. Okay, what are your bucket list hikes or best hikes of all time?
Oh, my God. Well, this hike I took over Elizabeth Pass in Kings Canyon, Sequoia National Park was truly amazing, up Dead Man Canyon. And that was really, really beautiful. And the weather up there is so incredibly crazy. That's one of the all-time great hikes.
How is it crazy?
Oh, it just changed. There's some kind of electrical something up in those peaks above Elizabeth Pass, I think, that creates really unsettled weather.
Mm.
And it's pretty scary up there, actually, I think, because the weather, everything changes so radically, so quickly.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. And it's incredibly beautiful. Oh, my God. It's some of the most beautiful places I've ever been, and I've been incredibly beautiful places. So that's one. I could name a bunch of others, probably, if you depends on how lightning you want this to be. Nine Lakes Basin, over on the other side of those mountains where that craziness happens,
right,
is this place called Nine Lakes Basin in Sequoia National Park, and it's just an incredibly beautiful, kind of untrampled area where I've been a few times. And one time went on a solo backpacking trip up in there, which was just great.
Okay. If it's not a solo hike, who is going on the hike and what are you doing after?
After, you mean, okay. My most constant companion for backpacking has been Barbara Higbee. And starting from just before the pandemic and all through the pandemic, we did a bunch of backpacking trips together. And she's my most constant companion backpacking because she is always full of wonder and never complains. And she's also just really a kind of a hoss. She keeps going. She's a lot slower than me, but that doesn't seem to bother her at all. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother her. So we're well suited for each other. I forget what the second part of that question was.
Well, if this was like an afternoon hike, oh, it sounds like you go on like overnight backpack and tents hikes.
Yeah.
But what is the activity following an afternoon hike?
Oh, these days, unfortunately, I have to fit them in. So in my schedule is kind of not my own anymore because I'm a full-time caregiver much of the time. But so after a hike, it might be that I have to run to the store and go shopping and cook dinner and clean up and do all that stuff. But it also, it definitely means there's some food involved because I have to eat, especially after a backpacking trip.
Right.
The next stop is going to be to a restaurant where you get to sit down and have somebody serve you and,
yeah,
and eat some good food.
This is what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay, speaking of that, what is your favorite tasty treat that is specific to Berkeley?
There's a popcorn that's made here that, not in Berkeley. No, it's made, I think it's made in Sebastopol.
We'll accept that.
Okay. I think it's called, this is going to sound so lame. I think it's called like cosmic corn or something like that. And the flavor I really like is hippie dust.
Awesome. Great. This all tracks. This all tracks. Cosmic corn, hippie dust. Okay. This is the last question. Who is your non-bluegrass or roots, non-roots music dream collaboration?
You mean they're not into roots music at all?
Right.
Oh. I don't know. I would love to do something with David Hidalgo of Los Lobos.
Oh. Listen, but that is very close
very
to
into,
a roots line.
I know, I know. It's very close to the roots line.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Our street team leader is Andrea Weber. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out at basicfolk.com. Search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk. Find us on Folk Alley's mobile app or folkalley.com. Or you can listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, send it to your aunt who is really into the natural health food store and always brings her reusable bags and has done so since the 1970s. Send it to her. Okay, talk to you next time. Bye.